This is a message from our sponsor. I'd like to introduce you to Publica by IAS, the award-winning CTV ad server trusted by some of the biggest streaming services and smart TV manufacturers globally. Publica helps a growing number of leading AVOD and FAST services to power the programmatic ad break decisioning via products including a unified auction, server-side ad insertion, and a demand-agnostic ad server built from the ground up around streaming. Head to getpublica.com to find out how they help CTV publishers to grow their advertising revenues and provide streaming audiences with linear-like TV ad break experiences. Welcome to the Marketecture Podcast. I'm Ari Papero. I'm joined by Eric Franchi and our special guest today, Shane Shevlin, the CEO of Bedrock Platform and a longtime ad tech executive with IP on Web. Shane, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Ari. Thank you.
Shane, is it IP on Web or IP on Web? Settle this for the Americans.
Yeah, I guess I've always said IP on Web, but I guess the original name did come from, you know, IP, intellectual property on the web. There's a whole story behind that, but I won't bore you with the details. But yeah, IP on Web, I think it's just easier. Rolls off the tongue, right?
Does it? Does it roll off the tongue, really?
All right.
Okay.
A bit more than IP.
We have some housekeeping, but before we do, So you're good friends with Kieran O'Kane, and so am I, and he clued me in that you and he are from the same tiny village in Ireland called Carrickmacross, and he claims it is the center of all ad tech in Europe, this tiny little village with like a one-room bank and a sheriff and whatnot. That's how he described it to me. How accurate is this?
Well, I guess that plays into Kieran's ego for sure, and maybe on some level per capita population, yes, okay, could be, but at least the capital, the ad tech capital of Ireland. But yes, it is true that we're from the same time. We sort of grew up together. In fact, he was a year older than me at school, but yeah, we've known each other since like age 9 or 10 or something.
Right, per capita, that might be, it's like the Baltimore of Europe in a sense. And if you get that right illusion, you've been in ad tech for way too long.
Yes.
All right, we skipped our housekeeping, so let's do some quick housekeeping. Okay, so last week we had the Listener Strike Back episode, and boy, that raised some eyebrows. So in that episode, Nandini from Check My Ads went to town on AdFontis Media, really, you know, criticizing their methodology. So in this episode, after we're done with the news of the week, we have a very short interview with Vanessa Otero, the founder of AdFontis Media, where she's going to rebut the rebuttal. And then we're going to call it quits. We're not going to continue doing this. So please stay tuned and listen to Vanessa talk about her methodology and why she thinks that Nandini's criticism is not accurate. Eric, you and I are going to be impossible, but I'm just going to be by the pool sipping margaritas and you're going to be working. So tell us why people should talk to you at Possible.
you, it's your choice whether or not you want to talk to me at Possible, but that's right. Ari and I will both be there. I think we're recording a special pod in separate rooms at some point during the week that was coordinated by you. But a few things going on. So Monday, ATG, Aperium, and MadTech are co-hosting a party. You've probably seen ATG post about it. You should sign up for it. And then I think that our whole sort of ad tech ecosystem is going to be hanging by the innovation village most of the time. So it'll be Aperium, like 25 other companies. You know, we'll have a presence there. You have a lot of cool presentations, a startup pitch competition. So check it out. And I'm sure you'll be able to run into one or both of us a few times over the course of the few days.
Just look for me by the pool. All right. Shane, we wanted to have you on because you're starting a new company, but also you have this long experience in this area that we could call customizable ad tech. And so do I. Through Beeswax, it was our real unique selling proposition was customizable ad tech. So I wanted to step back and say, you know, why? Why does everyone want customizable ad tech? You know, in other software industries, people are just like, yeah, fine, I'll use your email provider, I'll use your social provider. No one needs customizable aspects of those. But in this business, there seems to be a pretty strong vein of desire for owning your own tech.
Yeah, it's true, for better or for worse. I mean, I think the easiest way maybe for me to answer that question, Ari, is to give you an analogy, right? Do you guys wear a smartwatch? like an Apple Watch or a Garmin or no, shaking your heads. All right. So
not at all.
I do, right. Like, and I have a Garmin. I am an Apple fan, but I had a Garmin before the Apple Watch came out. So I'm a huge fan of the company. And, you know, I love what they built. It was an expensive piece of hardware. It's like $600 at the time or something, which was a lot back then. And it does everything, you know, besides cooking me an omelet in the morning for breakfast, right? It does everything so well. It's a fantastic piece of hardware combined with the software that they build in. But I guess, like, one of the things I noticed after I bought the watch was the altimeter didn't work really well, right? So it just, like, it's based off GPS, and depending on, like, when it was calibrated last or whether they've had an opportunity to calibrate based on your location, it can be actually wildly inaccurate. So if you go back to the same place geographically, like 2 days in a row, it's basically like a totally different reading, right? So I guess it transposed that into the world of ad tech or programmatic even, right? If you have a secret kind of GIS database that you can access and you essentially know always how far away you are from the seas, you can measure that like theoretical hypotenuse with, you know, the sort of straight line distance on the flat, you can ultimately, you know, use our friend Pythagoras to come up with the exact altitude that you're at. So say your business is like, I don't know, like making ice cream or something, and altitude is really important to you, right? So you need to like get the exactly correct atmospheric conditions to produce this beautiful ice cream. You need to know, and it's really important that you understand at what altitude you're at all times. I think if you had an opportunity to input that data into the watch, you would take the opportunity with both hands, right? So you could get an accurate reading. I think there's a similar use case or a set of use cases in programmatic where you have access to unique data assets and you know that you can drive better outcomes than, you know, some of the more generalist DSPs as an example in the market. And so you want to take advantage of that.
Right. So unique data was always the signal that our sales force at Beeswax used to know that the company might really be a good candidate to have a custom bidder. You know, we had companies that had B2B databases or location databases, things like that. But what about like an agency use case where maybe there isn't unique data? Is there really a compelling, can people prove out that they get better results by having custom bidders, custom tech, if they don't have any proprietary data, if it's just like moving the numbers around better?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, Ari. Like, so, you know, what does customization look like, right? It absolutely depends on where you sit in the ecosystem. And so, like, it doesn't necessarily always pertain to data. So it could be, you know, more to do with your supply chain. So what about your supply paths? And including proprietary access to supply, maybe in a customized tailored platform, right? Or just exclusive integrations, partnerships that you have with preferred supply that, you know, realistically, you're just never going to get done on one of the more generalist platforms, right? I think like the definition of custom, you know, should extend beyond data. I think data is the primary use case, you know, configurations and pricing formats, creative formats, you know, are all things that can be highly customized, right?
Yeah. One thing I'd always hear from industry folks was it was two sides of the same coin. On the one side, people would say it's stupid to have your own custom tech because the trade desk is pretty good. They have everything. You know, it's like, why are you building this from scratch? And then on the other hand, I would hear people say, when you're using a platform like the trade desk, you're working across purposes because they have their own SPO. So they're not going to do the SPO you want, and you may not get the inventory you want. And they have their own, you know, cookie matching or whatever, identity solution. So if you want your own, you need to build your own. Does that hold water for you?
Yeah, I think it does, right? So like coming back to sort of different forms of customization, it could be something as simple as excluding or including targeting constructs, right? That simply don't exist in the trade desk's UI or what have you. If you're a data vendor, you know, okay, you may have got an integration like many moons ago with one of the leading platforms, but discoverability of your product, you know, is kind of locked into whatever the taxonomy that the bigger platforms have brought forward, right? So, you know, whether that's still easily accessible today, relevant, et cetera, you know, I think in many cases it isn't. So there's a different jumping off point required for a lot of businesses, ad networks, data vendors, aggregators who actually, you know, just need a different point of activation of distribution, as it were.
A question, Eric, I wanted to get your point of view on something. One of the criticisms, or since I've often heard, is that from an investor perspective or from an M&A perspective, that if a company's too dependent on another company, like, you know, we don't want to acquire this company because they built on IP on web, or we don't want, you know, oh, this is just a beeswax reseller. What's proprietary do they have? Have you ever heard that sentiment? How do you think about it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been transactions that I've known that have, not moved forward because there was a critical dependency that just sort of, you know, kind of fell apart. I think the question that needs to be answered is, okay, if it's dependent on this partner, how durable is the relationship with that partner and that partner in general, right? Like, you know, in the case of IP on web, IP on web, you know, I don't think, like there were companies that exited for both, you know, kind of medium to massive amounts who were built on IP on web, right? So I think it's, you know, are you built on IP on web or are you like a Facebook PMD, right? And that people ran away from. So I think it's a little bit about who the partner is. If it is a partner that, you know, seems to be durable, I think, you know, that's okay, proceed. If it's not, is the use of proceeds in the case of like a strategic investment, or is the, you know, post-integration value creation plan to replace that by either building or attaching it to, you know, tools of the acquiring company. So it's right. Not a never, but it's often a never.
Shane, how did you see that play out when you were at IP? Did folks say, oh, well, we'll use you for a while, then we'll build our own so that we could go public or, you know, get acquired?
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it's a great question, guys. I think a lot of companies use us for testing and burning ideas, for sure. You know, like a lot of startups, we took a lot of venture capital money in the beginning, helped companies just sort of...
Shane, can you name names of companies over the years? And if it's not public info, don't do it. But, I mean, it's like legendary.
It is, Eric. But there's probably so many more names that I cannot name. Than name. I think it's best maybe if I stay away from that. But like, I think, yeah, it's like we would frequently actually get drafted in, you know, to speak to some of our customers, VC guys, like to actually set their minds at ease that, you know, what they were building on top of the infrastructure that we were offering was fairly sound. You know, like it was an interesting idea at least, and it was going to fly in the wild, right? You know, so there was that sort of vote of confidence that we had built, you know, big end-to-end stacks in the past and you know, that we could be trusted effectively to kind of deliver on the vision that the client had. Like, did we build for bigger companies who had successful exits? Absolutely. And we, you know, we built for companies that IPO'd. The question of ownership, you know, it was always something that was there. And, you know, we creatively constructed language around how we created intellectual property in various projects on behalf of clients. And that, you know, down the line, it got scrutinized, but the model was, you know, generally well understood, I would say.
What was the craziest use case?
Well, yeah, it's interesting you asked that, Eric. So when I joined the company, I remember going on a roadshow around the US, actually doing some sales, you know, sales pitches and whatnot with Derek O'Neill, the kind of CCO at the time. And I remember finding out that we had built, like, using the predictive modeling engine, we had actually helped build one of the sort of leading dating apps in the US, or helped like facilitate the matching process between, you know, prospective romantic partners. And I just thought that was wild, you know, like hearing that.
Wow.
But I yeah. So like, you know, completely unrelated to ad tech, but you do what you can, right?
Real time dating.
And that predated me, you know, that project. But it was really interesting to find that out. You know, beyond that, I think I would have to say, like, during my tenure, probably the most interesting project was the internal one that ended up becoming BitSwitch, because, you know, we had this very real world need at the time. We were building individual stacks, like dedicated hardware, you know, sort of reinventing the wheel every time we'd need to connect to Magnite. And it was just time consuming and was holding us back strategically, I guess. And the idea was conceptualized. Okay, so what if we could, you know, take the 200 millisecond window, whatever it was at the time, and like use, you know, 50 or 60 milliseconds of that to do some wacky kind of redistribution of bits. And we went to you know, our lead engineers with the idea, and they were like, nah, it's totally impossible. Like, there's no way, we got no time, there's laps of it, like, it's never going to fly. The business imperative was such that, like, we just went back and said, well, I think we really have to build this, you know, and it has to happen. And then by the, you know, by the end of the weekend, we had a prototype, and that was the brilliance of that company. It was just like, they could build anything. And, you know, it was mostly down to, I guess, you know, brilliant engineers put together with a brilliantly architected kind of set of composable applications that where you had a huge amount of flexibility, right?
Yeah, BitSwitch was sort of a breakout for IP on web, because previously IP on web was known as like all custom software, a little bit hard to work with, to be honest. Like, you kind of had to know somebody to get a good implementation. And then BitSwitch was a real product that you could actually, you know, log into and use, and had predictable activities. And right. My understanding is it's just like a massive cash machine at this point.
Yeah, yeah, it's a fantastic product, and it was definitely the moment. Like, although, you know, like, it was actually launched in 2013, which was quite a while ago. It's probably longer than a lot of people had maybe realized. And it took us a while to kind of, you know, create a level of trust within the industry that this service was actually doing what it purported to do, right? Which was, you know, very generic normalization and just handling the sort of the huge scale that comes with RTB. But yeah, you're right. Like, it was a kind of a growing up moment for us as a company. We worked on, you know, a number of really interesting projects up to that point, but BitSwitch was kind of like the first project or product that we owned and operated ourselves, like that we were, you know, on behalf of our own business rather than somebody else's.
Any chance of a BitSwitch spin out of Criteo? Looking for some private equity money? Get that to be independent again?
I know as much as you guys do. Like, I can't imagine Criteo look at it and think, oh, you know, that's not relevant to our business, right? There's such great distribution and scale there that I think it's probably on some level strategic to their overall ambitions within retail media. I don't know what that looks like today, but probably a question for Barry, Ari.
Sure. Speaking of scale, just to give you some context on scale, I'm just on the BitSwitch website, so this is public. There are 180 SSPs and 220 DSPs that connect to BitSwitch. So it's effectively the entire market.
Those are scary numbers, because I would challenge anyone, including myself, to name more than, say, 20 SSPs. Well, I want to make sure to talk about Bedrock. So you're back in with the same dream, the dream of customization, with this new company called Bedrock. There was an announcement a couple weeks ago, which was, you know, incredibly complimentary to me personally, and mentioned me a couple times, and I appreciate that. Not totally unnecessary, but I appreciate it. And so, you know, I thought we were over. I thought we were done with customization. I thought everyone was just going to use the Trade Desk and we'd be done, but apparently not. So tell me, what's the opportunity for Bedrock?
So, you know, thanks to trailblazers like yourself, Ari, and obviously my former employer, you know, there clearly is a market for building solutions for company, like building for the builders, essentially, right? And so that's what our vision is, to be the underlying infrastructure for companies to then go and scale on whatever level they see fit. And I think you might have called us a European ad tech company when you sort of gave us the chapeau on the episode of the podcast where you introduced us. And yes, it's true. We're out of London with, you know, our eye on many of the opportunities in Europe. But I think it's up to our customers to decide on what level they want to scale. So, you know, we're set up to scale globally at an infrastructure level. And so we welcome business from ad networks, you know, outside of the US, there's scale as well, guys, right? So I've had some really interesting conversations with some APAC-based companies, and also in Europe as well. I think, you know, there's some decent scale there as well.
Is Bedrock built on what used to be Avocet?
So we, as part of our funding, had the opportunity to inherit some assets from former ad tech companies that have either been acquired or realized they didn't have a need for certain components. One of those companies is Powerlinks, or formerly known as Powerlinks. So that's,
oh, yeah,
our chairman.
I remember them.
Yeah, you remember. So the the former native at Exchange. And so Kevin has come in as our chairman, and as part of our funding deal, we've inherited the assets there. So that's quite interesting, because it gives us a degree of flexibility when it comes to supply. And we're very much focused on the demand side and bringing forward infrastructure and smarts on the demand side. But the supply asset sort of gives us options when it comes to traffic shaping, right, curation, things like that.
For those of you who are not super ad tech nerds, PowerLinx was sort of like the app nexus of Native. Like, they connected demand and supply. Native is run by a guy named Kevin Flood, really nice, who is totally different from Vinny Flood, even though, are they both Irish? I've confused them so many times, it's really embarrassing.
No, Kevin's British.
Okay, well.
Yeah, Vinny's Irish, yeah.
Who do you think the customer base for Bedrock is going to be, Shane? You mentioned ad networks.
Yeah, so unashamedly, we're absolutely kind of positioning ourselves to help ad networks succeed, right? I think, if you're an ad network today, you've got, unique formats or unique data, you're not getting in the queue anymore for Trade Desk or DV, right? So the question then becomes, like, how do I get my, if you're a B2B publisher, for example, how do I get my, 1 million email addresses, into a point of distribution that where I've got control? If you're a regional, smaller version of Walmart, how do you ensure that all of that incredibly rich data is sort of transportable into the world of programmatic while sort of respecting data sovereignty and so on? Like, these are problems that have not really been solved yet. And so, we see ourselves hopefully at the vanguard of some of those solutions that will enable, more success with those types of companies.
Yeah, it could be good timing, given I think the Trade Desk definitely is not that interested in that kind of business. And then we don't know what's going on really with Xandr under Microsoft. I think there's a general perception they're going to focus more on O&O than their core business. So that could be a good opportunity for you. You might have timed it right.
Well, yeah, we hope so. And glad you think so, Ari.
I said might. All right. Well, thank you for that. Good luck with Bedrock. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with the news of the week. This week's episode is brought to you by Kevel's Retail Media Cloud. Built on an API-first foundation, this platform empowers retail media networks to flexibly customize ad experiences and enhance their data control, resulting in more tailored ad experiences for users. Don't settle for black box limitations or the costs of building alone. Kevel's Retail Media Cloud brings together the power of ad serving and CDP personalization to create on-site ads for retailers and marketplaces in a privacy-safe way. Launch a retail media network that your advertisers will love in as little as 14 days. To learn more, go to kevel.com/listen. That's kevel.com/listen.
All right, and we're back with the news of the week after taking a week off. So this week we've got more on AI, more drama on AI, some drama on the SSP front with a unique announcement out of Disney, more on Walmart and Vizio, and if we've got time, a little bit of Apple antitrust news. But let's talk about AI. So last week, we were just talking before the pod started. It was a slow news week, so we sort of kind of skipped news of the week during a slow news week. But one of the more noteworthy items was actually a post that you did, Ari, on AI. So if you recall, a couple weeks ago, Sam Altman had this interesting and controversial comment about how effectively 95% of what ad agencies do, as he understands it, will be replaced by AI. You wrote a post and posted it not only to the distro list, but on LinkedIn. And you went Gen X viral. I don't know who invented that term.
I've never heard that before. What does that mean?
I freaking love it. It means that you posted on LinkedIn and the comment section like lit on fire. There were more comments on that than I think anything else I've seen in 2024. Everybody had an opinion. So taking a look at like all the comments and all the conversation, that there were a ton. Did anybody change your mind?
No.
On your view of how AI is going to change this stuff?
Yeah, first of all, read the article. You should subscribe at news.marketecture.tv. I didn't give any hard predictions in my article. I sort of just covered the fact that agencies have enormous amount of headcount in hundreds of thousands of people, that a very large proportion of what they do is automatable. I think these are sort of undeniable facts. And then the two points I made were, first, that there are going to be some functions, I did not say all functions, some functions that may be eliminated entirely from the agency, may be replaced by technology that marketers can run themselves. And the second point was that the role of agencies will be more about strategic, creative, and coordination. And maybe I didn't say it as eloquently in writing as I'm saying it now. There's no chance of an AI coming up with Coke is it anytime soon. That requires sort of a level of human creativity that hopefully will continue indefinitely. And there's definitely a role for coordination. No one's expecting marketers to in-house, you know, a dozen complex interactive tools in the way that agencies help them. The comments were largely agreeing with me, but making the same points more aggressively. People were like, you know, a typical comment was something along the lines of, you're underestimating how much agencies do creativity and coordination, and marketers can't do that. And I was like, yeah, that's what I said, kind of. And then the other general point, which is always made about AI, is that if you free up people's drudgery, they'll do more high-value activities. And I don't disagree with that at all. I just don't think you need hundreds of thousands of people to do that. I will also say that I think in 2 weeks we have my friend Stefan Pretorius, who's the CTO of WPP, on this pod. So let's look forward to that. That should be a really fun conversation because he's super smart and it's his job to figure this out.
So another person related to WPP that also says some quotable stuff, aka Sir Martin Sorrell. He spoke at an Asian conference this week or last, and he effectively said the same thing you did. His quote was this, and I love it: "Turkeys don't vote for Christmas." He quipped, noting that there will be significant attrition in areas like media planning and buying, where the existing 200,000 plus employees in the media planning environment will be culled in favor of algorithms. He goes on to say, "The days where we rely on a 25-year-old media planner and buyer will be over." So funny that he managed to fit in like everybody's favorite stereotype right at the end of it, in addition to a real step. Yeah. But it's true. And you know, this stuff, people are getting very heated up about this topic. They're getting very heated up about another topic because it's uncomfortable. Like, the potential change and the potential disruption is really uncomfortable. So I'm not surprised that people are fired up and just want to talk about this. I guess maybe for Shane, you know, how are you thinking about AI as you build a new company?
Yeah, actually, incidentally, I also saw Sir Martin speak at Vinnie Flood's event, New Video Frontiers, in London last week. And, you know, he's so easy to listen to, Sir Martin. But there was a section of the discussion where they covered AI kind of in a fairly, you know, balanced manner. They covered just not just ad tech, but like, you know, the medical industry and medical device industry and you know, some of the potential benefits longer term there. I think we all need to be conscious of what's coming with AI as a founder CEO. We've had several cliff edge moments already at a product level where we're just like, you know, we're only a month in, and so AI is probably a little bit further down my priority list in terms of, you know, how we factored into the roadmap. But absolutely, like, you know, in some future version of the web, everything's potentially voice activated. You know, my kids, I don't think I've ever seen my kids type. Like, so, you know, that's quite scary as well. And ensuring that you're future-proofed as an ads business or an ads technology business for that eventuality, yeah, it's probably worth, you know, thinking about speculatively building some tools and applications potentially for you know, if the big switch if it ever came.
The thing that I'm just keeping an eye on is that it appears that many companies in media, buy and sell side, are really thinking of AI very incrementally, about how do we like resize images or how do we optimize our DSP, and I just think that's going to be a losing strategy. I think you need to blow things up and start saying, like, how do we start from nothing? What if we wanted to do these same tasks with AI and as few people as possible? How would we reorganize? Where would we invest?
Right. I think one thing's sure, though, is that, you know, agencies, like, I think somebody, I read your article, Ari, and the comments underneath, and somebody mentioned, like, cost. You know, it's not necessarily all going to be free, right? This great AI and, the, like, this magicking up of content and so on and so forth. But, you know, there is an infrastructure cost associated. I think agencies will figure that out and know how to make margin on it somehow. Yes, there'll be less people involved, but yeah, I don't worry for the health of the agencies, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's right. A couple of AI things that happened over the course of the past week or so. So Google announced that they have a product for news companies that they can tap into Google Gemini's generative AI tools to help them write articles. And I think that's a really interesting and, you know, I think it's a bit of a step function use case, which is, you know, there's like real-time things happening. Just very quickly get that stuff, get the beginnings of an article together, and then, you know, have some, you know, sort of human intervention, human follow through. But ultimately, if something can be trained on the voice of a publication, you could just have AI articles.
Yeah. So Alex Kantrowitz covered this. It was a bit of a scoop because people had heard that this was going around, but they weren't sure what it was. And the way he described it is that a journalist, a real human journalist, could accelerate what they do by potentially taking a tweet, let's say, that the governor publishes about some new initiative and just highlighting it and having Gemini turn it into a full article, or a announcement of your local community board and turn that into news as rapidly as possible, which I think is a little more interesting and less scary than this idea of ChatGPT, you know, blowing out low quality garbage article after article. So it'll be interesting to see if that turns into something real or if it's another sort of foray of Google into the news business.
Yeah, no, I think you're right in that it could be positive, particularly on a local level where there's just, you know, because of cost, there's just a dearth of local reporters, but there's a need for that information to get out. So the question is, you know, will the information be fair and quality? The other thing that I tracked was NBCU is using generative AI to map like show storylines to ads. And again, this is early stage. I think they're still at the pilot stage, but they're saying they're seeing a 49% of boost in effectiveness. I don't know what the effectiveness is, but basically it is content that delivers or elicits some sort of emotional connection. They're matching advertisers based on, you know, just the show content, which is completely new. And it's, you know, a little bit incremental, but it's interesting. So, you know, I think every week we're going to have more of this stuff coming out, and overall pretty excited.
I've heard a lot of people talk about emotion lately as it relates to CTV ads and CTV content. It feels like something we're going to hear a lot more of the next couple of months about matching emotional content of the emotional impact of the content to the ad. You don't want your ad showing after, you know, some overly dramatic scenes and things like that.
Yeah, we invested in a company that's still in stealth that is doing just that. So agreed. It's going to be a fun area.
And my investment in Iris TV, I think, is offering that in some form.
Yep, our investment.
Sorry.
Okay, all right, next one. it's okay. Inside Marketecture Baseball. So AI fires people up. There's only one thing that I think might fire up people more, and it's this whole blurring of the lines between SSPs and DSPs and clear lines, open paths, all that good stuff. So there was an announcement this week that Disney is making their inventory available via the Google and TTD DSPs directly. So, you know, purportedly Disney Plus and Hulu ads will be available to a lot more advertisers. And, you know, Disney's got the stated goal of making 50% of their digital revenue transacted programmatically over the next few years. And then there was a Twitter fight about it.
Of course.
So,
of course.
So Shiv from you of Digital, who's just great. He is just like one of the best tweeters. He basically kind of posted something in jest, which was okay. You know, the article says that they're cutting out SSPs, but they're not really cutting out SSPs. What's your take on this whole thing, Ari? And is this worth everybody literally having a fight where they're calling each other names over in this thread?
They're clearly cutting out SSPs. I don't see how they're not cutting out SSPs. And that's definitely bad for SSPs. Those seem like facts. I think there is a growth story here, though. If you've ever been in the DSP business, you will know that Disney Hulu is the worst. Like, they're just so hard to work with. They have weird contracts. They don't let you log things. They have all these data requirements. And as a result, the proportion of programmatic revenue they get is probably radically lower than their peers. So there's a story here that says that they're trying to fix this in a sense by having deeper connections, and it should grow the pie of programmatic for Disney and Hulu. in general, and not necessarily hurt the existing pipes, which are, you know, which are producing some revenue, but not as effective as they might be. But that's a very Disney-specific thing. Overall, I think we clearly see a trend of reducing number of hops, which reduces the percentage that's going to vendors, which is kind of probably bad for them.
Yeah, and increases transparency and probably has more "quote unquote" working dollars put to work on the demand side. Shin, what's your take on all this, if any?
Yeah, I guess I agree. Like, the walls just keep getting higher, right? Which is just a little frustrating, I think, for any large advertisers who really want access to quality video. I heard in one of the groups, or saw in one of the groups, the industry groups I'm a member of this week, the possibility potentially that the Digital Markets Act in Europe could come back to kind of haunt Google or YouTube at some point as well, which, you know, is an interesting take.
Yeah, I want to jump on that. We're going to talk about that.
Yeah, go on. Keep going.
Yeah, so the Digital Markets Act, which is causing all kinds of news in tech right now because Apple and Google are being subject to a lot of regulatory overview. Someone pointed out that YouTube is considered a covered company under DMA, and because it's big enough that it hits the requirements, and that their exclusion of other DSPs and favoritism towards DV360 is a viable candidate for regulatory action in Europe, whereas in the US it has not been.
Yeah, it's a really interesting take, and if they've been categorized as one of the so-called gatekeepers, then sure, right? Like, I think, you know, there is a clear case that DV is being favored essentially by what is effectively the same parent company.
So Shane, I have to ask you, like, as an independent DSP now, Bedrock, you're running, isn't there an argument that deals like this, not YouTube, but deals like the Disney Trade Desk deal, that's tough for a small DSP to reproduce, and that's part of the argument against having customized tech, that you have to reproduce all these high margin sort of relationships that are difficult for small companies to do. How would you react to that?
Yeah, it's a challenge for sure. But, you know, to quote your good self, you know, when you said let 1,000 ad networks bloom, like you need to start somewhere, you know, and ad networks usually start from, you know, preferential access to either partner data, unique data, or, you know, preferred suppliers, something like that. So, you know, we're hoping to essentially remove some of the friction that goes with basically the heavy lifting component of actually trading and growing that set of assets quickly, right, and getting to scale. So, yes, well, I do absolutely agree that these sorts of developments are a little depressing on some level. I think us 20%ers can continue to be hopeful that we can grow our share of the pie.
And by us 20%ers, you mean effectively the 20% of digital ad spend that is non-walled garden?
Right, exactly.
Us 20%ers. That's great. Let's stay on this regulatory beat for 1 second. So in addition to what we just covered, the Justice Department is suing Apple for allegedly that they are monopolizing smartphone markets. And the sort of subheader here is Apple's broad-based exclusionary conduct makes it harder for Americans to switch smartphones, undermines innovation for apps, products, and services, and imposes extraordinary costs on developers, businesses, and consumers. And in the post, which I'm sure Ari, you'll link to in the newsletter, you know, there's a few areas that they're honing in on. A lot of this is, you know, iMessage versus the green bubble, you know, inability to switch to other smart watches, blocking so-called super apps. How much of this might, you know, touch the ad space? And just given how much, you know, Apple has been, you know, blamed for, you know, sort of things like Snap losing revenue, Meta losing revenue, at least initially.
Yeah, not at all. So the case, like any antitrust case, pivots around the definition of the market. They very clearly define the market as high-end smartphones. So their antitrust claim is that Apple's activities makes it harder for consumers to switch phones. I don't see an argument that is really feasible that says that preventing apps from making money by ads prevents consumers from switching phones. I mean, maybe you can make the argument, but it's like a real stretch. The activities of Apple in its app store, its commission rate and things like that are really not addressed in the antitrust case. So this case is sort of, I don't want to say it misses the mark, but it's hitting a different mark. I don't think there's anything to prevent other parts of the government from going after Apple's activities in app store commissions, but this case clearly doesn't.
Got it. Makes perfect sense. Okay, we'll hit one more and then we'll close it out. So Walmart announced they were acquiring Vizio a few weeks ago. One of the things that we brought up actually in the conversation was that Vizio is a key partner in CTV data, specifically for ACR data. And Wall Street Journal had an article that reported that effectively Walmart might stop the licensing of the data. So, you know, the ACR data via Vizio is licensed by marketers and agencies and analytics companies like iSpot TV. And it sounds like the plan is that the data will be honored now, like for existing contracts, and then not renewing them whenever the renewal cycle happens. So effectively cutting off access to the largest pool of ACR data. What do you guys think about this? So does this like make Walmart stronger because they've got this proprietary ACR data, and you know, by virtue of that, do they become, you know, even more of a, or perhaps for the first time, a must buy? Or is it just like NA and there'll be other data sources that, you know, the market can just pick up and sort of stitch together?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a shortage of ACR data. It's not easy to get your hands on it. The leading providers like Samba TV and LG have semi-exclusive relationships already. And the Vizio data for targeting, as an example, was exclusively available or is exclusively available in the Yahoo DSP. You have to presume that's not going to renew. And that's one of the major selling points of the Yahoo DSP. There are definitely reverberations, maybe good for the trade desk because Walmart has their relationship with the trade desk. Maybe Vizio data becomes available as part of that relationship. But now I'm speculating. Definitely is a strong play for Walmart. I mean, why give other people the data, right? More for them, less for everybody else.
Yeah. I guess it strengthens the walls of the walled garden, so to speak.
Maybe increases the valuation of the LG spinoff that we're all waiting for, right?
That's true. Shane, what'd you have to say on that one?
Yeah, I mean, if it does come to pass, what you said, Ari, on the trade desk front, like I guess. Bunch of customers can look forward to their, you know, their roadmap request items being bumped down by, you know, bumped back by a couple of months at least, right?
Shane, is ACR data even legal in Europe? Is it available?
That's a good question. I don't know. What is it classified as, technically?
Well, they link IP address to viewing behavior, so that would be an identifier under GDPR. You would certainly need consent. I just wonder...
Right, you need consent, exactly.
I just wonder if... because I don't think... I haven't heard a lot about TV-based targeting in Europe, so I was just wondering.
Yeah, I do not know.
All right, so I think that's a wrap. So Shane Shevlin from Bedrock Platform, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Huge fan of the pod, guys. Keep up the great work.
Eric, I will see you in Miami. You're off next week, so I'll have to do News of the Week myself. I'll just talk to myself. And everyone, please keep tuning in. We have Vanessa Otero from AdFontes Media with a rebuttal of the rebuttal of the rebuttal. So look forward to that. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
All right. I am happy to have Vanessa Otero, the founder and CEO of AdFontes Media, here. Vanessa, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Ari.
So the background here is that we did a in-depth interview with Lou Pascalis, the chief strategy officer for AdFontes. It's available on Marketecture TV without a subscription. You should go listen to that, where Lou took us through what AdFontes does, how it creates its media bias ratings, those being available on the trade desk, what the methodology is. And then on last week's pod, we had a special episode called Listener Strike Back, which I hope you listened to, got a lot of reaction. And Nandini from Check My Ads came on and was pretty critical of AdFontes and said a number of criticisms of what AdFontes does and how it does it. So we wanted to have Vanessa on to give her side of the story. So Vanessa, for those who aren't super familiar, why don't you give us the really quick elevator pitch on what AdFontes does?
Yeah, absolutely. AdFontes Media, we rate news and news-like sources for reliability and bias. And we do that for websites, TV programs, video, podcasts, and audio.
So I'm going to sort of paraphrase what Nandini said into two themes. So the first theme, probably her biggest theme, is that she feels like Ad Fontes is playing both sides and saying that the left-leaning publications are just as bad as the right-leaning publications. And she makes the point that some of the right-leaning publications shouldn't even be considered journalism. There are basically things like RT News, which is a propaganda outlet of the Russian government, or the Heritage Foundation, which is extremely right-wing organization. And that by putting them both on the same chart, you're legitimizing, in a way, the right-wing stuff, which should absolutely be, you know, in a different category. And I hope I'm not mischaracterizing her argument, but I think that's basically her strongest argument. So how do you feel about that?
You know, those are the points I wanted to address as well, because, you know, this is not the first time that Nandini has criticized our methodology. You know, I've seen it on social media. And, you know, her approach tends to be about creating confrontations on social media. And typically that's not our approach. It's not our focus. So we try not to spend a lot of time on that. Our approach truly is about problem solving, like for as many people as we can across the media ecosystem. And like you said, we have these huge problems about like the loss of reliable journalism, about misinformation, about polarization. And like I truly believe that solving these problems at scale for brands, and like it involves and it requires data, like objective as possible data on these two measures of reliability and bias. So on the issue of there's a couple of main objections. One is, as you mentioned, even placing outlets on the same chart. So you mentioned RT and Heritage Foundation, you know, as you and she characterize, like far right. Like, why even put them on the same chart? Now, we're not walking into this discussion saying, here's a chart of all journalism. It's media, it's news and news-like sources. And like, there's no barrier of entry to who gets to publish media information, news and politics information. Everybody can publish it. Everybody does publish it. So it's not like we're lending legitimacy to RT. Like, RT is more famous than Ad Fontes Media. The Joe Rogan podcast is more famous than Ad Fontes Media. So people are already getting their information from these news sources, and we're grading it. Like, there's labels like clearly on the side of the chart, from like good at the top to okay in the middle to like bad at the bottom. And the argument is sort of like saying, all right, we have a bunch of students in class, and some are A students or some are F students, but like we don't even want to dignify the D and F students with a grade. Like, they should just not even be in the class. But like, we categorize stuff. Like, we can grade stuff. And there is a section on the chart that says, this below opinion that says selective, incomplete, unfair persuasion, propaganda. And yet a lot of RT content falls in that particular area. But you get caught in this trap, like most measures of their criticism of media is very ad hoc. Like, people will pull from the different examples that they think in their mind are really instructive. So Nandini pulled examples from Jezebel, The Root, saying like, oh, they tell these stories for these marginalized communities. And Heritage Foundation has dark money, and RT is owned by the Russian government. Like, those are all different factors that one could use to say, like, this is why this news source is good or bad. But then you get in this trap of people saying, well, look at this one article from the New York Times. I think that's propaganda. So you say RT is propaganda. I say New York Times is propaganda. The only way you could actually come to some sort of objective measure of it is by looking at all the content and trying to like parse how much of each one happens.
I get it. I guess I could put the argument in a different way, more of an analytic way, which is the center line on your horseshoe chart or your mustache chart, I guess you sometimes call it. Maybe the center line shouldn't be centered. Basically, the people on the bottom left of the mustache are the leftish sort of publications. The people on the bottom right are Russian propagandists, and your chart implies that they're equally unreliable. That's a different way of phrasing the same argument.
It's a complaint for folks on the left. Both sides of them is a complaint,
yeah,
of the left. So, but the more closely, the more like nuanced you look at it, that's not what the data actually says at all. So the category in the middle, we don't call it center. We call it middle, and we do that really purposely because there are a lot of things that can fall in the middle for different reasons. So you can be in the middle because you truly are minimally biased, like trying to have it as straightforward as possible. You can be in the middle because you exhibit a centrist bias, like Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, for example. Or you can be in the middle because there's a balance of biases that are on the left and right. Like you can have a show where you have a far left and far right person, and that would shake out to the middle. Joe Rogan is a good example. You know, he's at the bottom middle of the chart, which is an unusual place because he's got far left and far right and, you know, apolitical guests all the time, very popular. But why the rating is towards the bottom is because, you know,
he thinks the aliens built the pyramids. That's why.
He has a lot of very unreliable guests. Like, and that's most of the content of those shows. Yeah.
So let me ask a different, there's the last question on this topic, which is, can you fall off the chart? Like, if there was a publication that was advocating genocide, are they still on the chart? Or is there some point at which it's like, this is, you're off the chart. You're too far to the right.
Well, that content exists out there, you know, and people like visit it and people read it. And we're not trying to make a value judgment on, like, you know, you mentioned the Overton window. Like, we're just trying to measure what the media is right now. So if there is media that's saying that, like, you can characterize it that it's got inaccurate information, that it's the furthest to the right you could possibly get, you know? So it, like, not having, I think it's important to capture, like, what the outer bounds are, because if you just say that, like, well, people will say, oh, Vox with a V should be the furthest to the left, or Fox News, it should be the furthest to the right. If you look at what exists out there, there's stuff that's way further left and way further right than that. And it's good to know because your relatives are reading that stuff.
All right. So the second criticism, and I think she brought this up first in the podcast, is that there is a racial bias or a bias toward on the left side where publications that cater to people of color or women are considered less reliable and more liberal. Do you care to address that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a pretty unfair characterization to say we're racist at best. I mean, I'm a Filipino daughter of immigrants. I'm a lesbian. Like, I have lots of conservative critics, and I'll share with you what their criticisms of me are. You know, folks on the right have gone up and, you know, checked who what party I've been registered to vote for, and it's Democrat, and who what my campaign donations have gone to in the past before I started Ad Fontes Media. This is all publicly available information that they will surface. I think it's a total of about $1,700 over my entire lifetime to Democratic candidates. I have since not, you know, donated since I started this company and try to stay as apolitical as possible. But we all come from a background of our own political viewpoints.
I want to interrupt you for one second. I don't think she was calling you racist, and I certainly wasn't. I think she was implying that your methodology may produce results that are unfair to those publications.
And the examples that she gave were Jezebel and The Root, by saying that, like, you know, it, like, The Root tells the stories of, you know, Black communities and, like, the points of view of Black people. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the content is always true and doesn't have bias. We're measuring reliability and bias. There are other publications, like BET is also targeted to the Black community, and it has a much higher reliability score and a much lower bias score. It's different kinds of content. Like, she quoted to Jezebel, which is for women's issues. Well, there's Smart Her News, which is, like, dedicated towards, like, towards women and focused on women's news, and it has got, like, a very low bias, high reliability score. So you can't just say that because a publication is about certain communities that it can't be have more or less bias. Like, there's stuff from, like, we have this characterized. You can actually, like, search it on our chart, like LGBT focused, targeted, or BIPOC focused, or hosted. And there's a range from, like, high reliability, minimal bias, to low reliability, high bias. Like, there's just a range. That's just what the content is.
All right. Well, that was an excellent conversation. Vanessa Otero from Ad Fontes, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on, Ari.
And listeners, we really want to continue hearing this feedback. Just slide into my DMs or just blast me on social. It's always good. I have thick skin. So thank you Thank you for listening.
Thank you for subscribing to Marketecture. New interviews are added every week at marketecture.tv and your favorite podcasting app.